Welcome, guys, to episode 57 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and this week we are blessed to have Tony Blauer on the show. Now, Tony is the founder of the Spear System and is also the guy when it comes to combat within the CrossFit world. I've had a couple of combatants on the show before. I had Chris Liddell and Tim Kennedy, both from the UFC. But Tony's angle on combat is very different. It's very unique. It's more of the initial startle reflex, what happens when you're not expecting it type combat scenario versus Tim and Chris that are more within the cage. Even though when I say that, Tim Kennedy's sheepdog response obviously addresses the same kind of thing. So we delve into combat. We delve in combat for the law enforcement officer, but also the medic and the firefighter. We more often than not are going to be involved in a situation out of the blue, whether it's a diabetic or postictal patient, an angry homeowner that thinks that we're not acting fast enough, as well as obviously our law enforcement brothers and sisters that are, obviously a threat every day of their life. So we really delved in deeply to that, to combatives. We talked about an array of subjects from his favorite movies all the way through to not bashing on martial arts, but realizing the strengths and weaknesses of individual martial arts. So it was another amazing conversation, an area that I'm very passionate about. I've been a martial artist my whole life, but I can't wait to delve into Tony's work even more when I attend his seminar in 2018. So before I talk about this, please, please, please go on iTunes, rate the show. The more good ratings, 5-star ratings we get, the more visible we are to other first responders. I love seeing your feedback. Make it honest. I mean, hopefully you love the show. If there's some things that you see that we can improve on, then by all means, let me know as well. And another thing, let me know if there's potential guests. I love getting input from people about other people that would be valuable minds for you guys to delve into. So without further ado, I introduce to you Tony Blauer. Enjoy. All right, so welcome, Tony, to the Behind the Shield podcast. Where are we finding you geographically today?
I am actually in my home gym near San Diego, California.
Fantastic. And were you born and bred in California?
No, actually, I'm formerly of Canada, and Montreal is where I grew up. I moved to the States in 2008.
Okay, yeah. Montreal's a beautiful city. I used to work in upstate New York. We used to go there on our days off sometimes. It's gorgeous up there.
Yeah, it's a pretty city.
Okay, so tell me about your upbringing. What did your mom and dad do? How many siblings did you have? That kind of thing.
Oh, wow, we're going deep. I was actually raised by wolves.
That explains a lot.
So, seriously, let's see. So I grew up in the 60s and, my mom was of that era, the typical stay at home mom. My dad was in the clothing import business. So he imported ladies' clothing from Europe, and that was kind of like a family business. His dad did that. He had a manufacturing import. So I grew up around, that type of industrial, at the factory every weekend. My dad worked 7 days a week. Middle class ish, but I grew up in the in kind of that black and white turning to color TV generation, and the shows that kind of influenced me were the original Green Hornet with Bruce Lee, the original Wild Wild West with Robert Conrad. So, I had this infatuation with television and any type of fighting. I was just, for some reason, just spoke to me. I was glued to the TV. And I remember, seeing, because everything was filmed, Streets of San Francisco and Mannix and all, it was all filmed out in California. And they always had those classic shots – of the Hollywood Hills and the, you know, LA airport. And I it was just burned into my brain. And when I was 13, my dad took us to California to Disney. When I got off the airplane and I saw it, I remember distinctly saying, oh my God, I'm going to live here one day. This is where I'm going to live. So, you know, 50 years later, that happened.
All right. And was your upbringing rough? Was there a lot of violence in your childhood and teens?
No, I grew up in kind of like a you know, suburban area. The normal fears, you know, I had later on, I had students of mine who would tell me like that they had a fight every single day going to school. You know, if their mom said, you know, go to the store and get a loaf of bread, that there was a good chance that they were going to get jumped somewhere and just some like shitty areas. And I, you know, there was the normal bully crap at school. And, you know, I had, you know, a few fights. I got jumped once by two guys from high school. And that's a fun and interesting story, but it was pretty much kind of a nice suburban area. And the only kind of violence was stuff you'd either see in the news or the, you know, the bully type of stuff at school. Nothing that would have, you know, suggested, if you looked at my childhood, oh, this guy's going to like develop a behaviorally based approach to personal defense and combative. So it was kind of an anomaly.
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, it's a similar thing to what I went through. I grew up on a farm. So the only violence I was at the hands of was either a goat or a horse or some other four-legged beast.
And those goats can be pretty dangerous.
They can. But, you know, so it was the fear of the unknown. So that's why I jumped into the martial arts at a pretty young age and studied ever since. So what took you to your first martial arts class?
Again, like I said earlier, I infatuated with all types of fighting. So, you know, if there's a fight on some TV show, which there always were, and they're always the stylized, you know, like Sinatra and Manchurian Candidate, and you know, the most exotic stuff, of course, was, you know, the Green Hornet stuff, and then you know, some cool, you know, 1-2s on Wild Wild West. Robert Conrad was a, you know, semi-pro boxer with a love of fighting. And so he choreographed his own stuff. And I was just infatuated with that stuff. And it spoke to me it in a way that I went, I've got to understand this more. I've got to pursue this. And then it was like 1973 and Bruce Lee passed away and that craze hit everybody. And you know, suddenly there was, you know, martial arts all over the place. A school, a Taekwondo school opened near me, not that near, like, you know, several miles away, but it was the only school in the area. The instructor there, Alex, was a real good guy, and so it was a good thing because, you know, it was the only choice I had. So it turned out that this guy was kind of cool and ran really good classes. But that was my first art when I was 13, was Taekwondo, which I think was like almost everybody's first art, depending on what era you grew up in. And that's where that kicked off, you know. But I had this fascination, of course, with everything Bruce Lee. So the whole eclectic Tao Ji Kune Do, start reading all the stuff and go, oh, I got to check out Wing Chun. I got to check out boxing. I got to check out fencing. I've got to, cause everyone was trying to emulate his form and his philosophy.
Yeah. And I did exactly the same thing. I had all the posters. I had the Wing Chun dummy that I never actually got to use properly because I never took any classes for it. But yeah, I mean, his whole philosophy was incredible. And I think it's, you know, you can attribute both CrossFit and MMA. You know, he was kind of visioning that probably 50 years prior to it really coming to the fruition out in, you know, modern day world.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, like a lot of people intuitively cross train. A lot of people intuitively blended ranges. But if you were, you know, some martial artist living on the side of a hill without internet, you know, without a news outlet, and you were, you know, you got into a fight where someone threw a punch and you ducked under and grabbed the guy, threw him to the ground, and sat up on top of him, punched him in the face and scrambled. I mean, you know, you didn't go, oh shit, mixed martial arts, you know, like you, like that was just the fight. And I think a lot of confrontations always blend stuff. It wasn't until there was a platform like mixed martial art where the limitation of your arsenal was revealed, because you were forced to fight 3 5-minute rounds or five rounds or, you know, but I think there was always mixed martial art is what I'm saying. We just didn't call it that. And there was always CrossFit. We just didn't call it that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I agree 100%. I think our, for example, the training side, we got really sucked into the whole bodybuilding world, and I'm not demonizing that at all, but we got pulled into a gym with machines instead of, you know, as you said, cross training, which would have been modern day life up to that point.
Right. Yeah, the you know, we've been domesticated and we've been compartmentalized. You know, one of the things I talk about when, you know, when I'm doing talks on human weapon system theory is that there was a time in our life where, you know, men and women knew how to defend themselves, and it wasn't cavalier when I say that. People vision, and this interesting thing about biases and cognitive dissonance and unconscious bias is that when I say the statement, you know, go back a couple hundred years and everybody knew how to shoot. Everyone knew how to hunt, men and women, or you didn't survive. And people visualize, you know, heroic movement from movies, not realizing that movies are glamorizing movement, right? But, you know, so if I say, hey, if you went into town to, you know, go sell a little bit of gold or some pelts to feed your family, and some, you know, marauders, you know, bad guys, you know, came onto your property, there was your wife, you know, on the balcony with her gun, or, you know, on the porch with her gun. And when I describe that, I can see people's faces going, you know, like, oh yeah, that, you know, that was Calamity Jane. They visualize some movie icon as opposed to a terrified woman shaking, but knowing that if she doesn't stand her ground and shoot this guy, that she's going to get raped and murdered anyhow. And you know where I'm going with this is like there's this idea that the idea that you're going to protect yourself and your family requires some sort of stylistic skill and finesse. And while that's ideal, if you can get to that, more people just defend themselves just because it's the thing they need to do to survive. And it's not about technique, it's about tactics.
Yeah, yeah. And I think you see that in the training world as well, where we've been dumbed down and softened in such a way that when you tell someone, oh, you can pick up this 100-pound, you know, strongman bag and just walk with it, people look at you like you're crazy. And it's like, well, what would you have done to carry, you know, food back to your house a few hundred years ago, or water, or all these other the things that you had to do to survive? But now we're looking at basic human movement like, oh, that's above my ability. I'm going to get hurt if I do that.
Right. I mean, just, even squatting, you know, just walking, you know, transportation. Like there was a time when, you know, you walked. When I would want to go to my Taekwondo school, it was a 3-mile walk if my mother couldn't drive me, you know, and you would just do it. You know, these days with, you know, smartphones have made people pretty dumb, and you know, we sit at desks and are fucking up our posture, and, you know, bad neck position and carpal tunnel, and, you know, you got to find that balance, and you can't, you know, and it's taken me a long time to realize this, even though I've been, you know, very athletic and I've been moving my whole life, you know, the last 10, 15 years running the business, I'm doing less of the seminars and less of the teaching now that I've got like a, you know, mobile training team and I'm working with them. But I do notice, you know, that I am screwing up my body by allowing, you know, work and those forced positions, like working out on a machine instead of working out outside or doing strongman shit, or and at least blending it in there. We can't forget that our body's everything, and the connection to our mind and our stress levels.
Yeah, no, I agree 100%. You're just doing this podcast and being on the social media more, trying to promote it and share certain things. I feel it even in my neck, just looking down at that damn phone more than I used to. So Yeah, it's definitely a real thing. Now I want to kind of scale back for a moment. So you were doing your Taekwondo. At what point in that journey in the martial arts did you realize that the application of some of the traditional martial arts wasn't coming to fruition when it came to a real street fight?
It took me a few years. It's interesting because I had several confrontations, you know, between the age of 13 and let's say, 21, 20, when I really started to experiment with / innovate scenario-based training. You got to remember, like back then, like there was no term stress inoculation and reverse engineer and scenario, you know, based training. This was 13 years pre-UFC. This was years before, like Red Man, you know, any type of like decades before any like scenario equipment and stuff, where I was in confrontations. It's interesting conversation for certainly, I don't know what your demographics are. Some people might be bored to death with the story, but people who are into training and self-defense and martial arts will find this interesting, because, you know, one of the things that I really push now is not to confuse techniques and tactics. Don't confuse being technical with being tactical. At the end of the day, being tactical is everything. And the fixation on where should your foot go? How should your fist be? Should I turn my hips here? When he does this, I'll do that. That takes you out of the spontaneity of the fight. And so the biggest thing here is when I was in the confrontations, my Taekwondo never manifested itself. Like it wasn't like there. The confrontations were always in confined spaces. They were close. I remember one road rage thing where a guy jumped out of his car. So I jumped out of mine because I didn't want to get caught sitting down, and he attacked me. Next thing we're doing is we're fighting on top of, the trunk of my car against the car. Like, you know, and this is, you know, it was crazy. I had another confrontation in high school where my back was to the wall. You know, the teacher had stepped out of the room and the guy was so close to me that, and I couldn't step back, but my predisposition, the unconscious bias I had from years of Taekwondo was to kick the guy. But I had my back to the wall and he was just outside of striking range. So he was too far to knee, too close to kick. And that was your basic arsenal in Taekwondo. And I didn't feel like a back fist to the face was the thing to do, right? And I didn't have the room, and there's the desks there and the kids are going fight, all the bullshit going on. And I remember, you know, we ended up just exploding into, you know, this confrontation that, when he swung at me, I flinched. I don't know anything about startle flinch at the time. You know, it was like 1975, I was 15 or something. And, I flinch, his hand bounces off my forearm, but his head, because of the way we fell from what we now call as a protective spear, where you're part of you is covering your head and part of you is pushing away danger. This is a physiological response. It's organic. You don't even have to think about it. It's almost like, you know, an airbag deploying. But his head ended up right near my hands when he threw that classic sucker punch. And I grabbed his head. We now call that closest weapon, closest target, where like a target just appears where it appears. Had I been thinking at the time, where should I be? Where should my foot be? I got to create space. I'd have been screwed. But what I did is I intuitively just grabbed him by the hair. And I forgot to mention, because at the time and until several iterations of the UFC, nobody thought of wrestling as an amazing foundation and platform, right? So I had wrestled for many years before Taekwondo. And so when I grabbed his head, I turned that right into an improvised hip throw, threw him on the ground. He was right like underneath me. I grabbed him. I still had his hair in my hands, and I yanked him and I threw him sideways into two desks. And the desks hit him from behind and winded him, and he's on the ground stunned. I haven't done any, like, martial taekwondo. I haven't done any technical wrestling. It was just, oh shit, right? This explosion. And I remember, and I laugh about this because when I whipped him into the desks and stunned him, I then found myself like in a classic low, you know, martial arts stance, pointing at him saying, if you get up, I'll fucking drop you, you know, like, and it was like, I noticed like that was the first time I was in a stance and the fight was over. But here's what I did. And this is the point of the whole story, introspectively and ironically, I realized that we were at boxing range and I didn't know anything about boxing other than messing around on a bag. And I immediately signed up for boxing lessons. So what I was doing, like in the eclectic philosophy, I was, you know, adding tools to my toolbox. And so I went to study boxing, not recognizing at the time, I mean, I was too young and too inexperienced, that the reason for the confrontation is I didn't really understand situational awareness and what can trigger and lead up to a fight. I didn't understand deeply verbal de-escalation. I didn't fully grasp like the moral, ethical, legal elements of a total confrontation. And I looked at it like many people, even here we are decades later today, look at it as, oh, you know, if I learn jiu-jitsu and I learn taekwondo and I learn boxing and I learn Krav Maga, like then I'll be able to protect myself. And the evidence for that, like I'm talking about CCTV, body cam, dashboard video, the evidence completely contradicts all that. So sorry for the rant, man. I just like my brain gets going. And I just start firing. But the epiphany was years later realizing that like it's not the, you know, it's not like filling up your toolbox with the best moves, the Frankenstein system, as it were, the best moves of from each style. I mean, LAPD tried to do that years ago, right? By bringing in, they had Benny Urquidez and the Gracies and the Machados and about 15 other high level. Like, you know, LA is like a melting pot for some of the greatest martial artists in the world. And they brought them all in and extracted like their best movements. And I remember being interviewed about it. And I was doing a short workshop for them. And they asked me what I thought about it. And I said, it's amazing that you get to work with all these people, but I don't see it working just in the same way Frankenstein didn't work. You can't just remotely add best moves. So like these guys are like lifelong martial artists and they pull off stuff in a controlled, albeit dangerous, but a controlled environment, right? It's not like in the street. They don't have a gun on them and they don't, you know, and the initial attack on a police officer is going to also involve an emotional and psychological assault, which now decades later we know from neuroscience that your, you know, the lizard brain, the reptilian brain, the limbic system, amygdala bypasses cognition. And that's why we say, that's why we see, and I alluded to dashboard video, body cam, CCTV. I tell people, careful what you practice. You might get really good at the wrong thing. And then that's my jab and my cross is, it's not what we believe. It's what we see that counts. It's not what we believe, meaning I believe this move's going to work. But what we see when we're actually studying real violence is very few of the complex motor skills that are taught ever manifest themselves in a real violent encounter.
Yeah. Well, I had that same realization because I did Taekwondo as well for several years, even won national championships in Britain. And you know, it was all the ITF, skippy, tappy, tappy stuff, which was awesome. And I went on to be a stuntman for a while. It served that purpose very well for the screen. But as far as realism, just to go from Taekwondo into just a regular kickboxing gym and getting my ass handed to me pretty much on day one by someone that had maybe a few months training made me realize about, you know, the weaknesses of certain arts. But then, as you were saying, you know, you fill that toolbox with too many things. You spend, you know, so much time working out what you're even going to use. It's already too late. And I love the quote that I actually put on Instagram the other day that Bruce Lee said, I think it was, I don't fear a man with 10,000 kicks. I fear the man who's trained one kick 10,000 times.
Right. As long as it was the right kick at the right time.
Exactly.
I've got I get asked at seminars, sometimes it's an innocent question, but very often it's somebody going, guys, can you look at me for a second? And so guys will go, instead of practicing a movement protocol based on a scenario, because everything we do, Simon Sinek, who got famous for the start with a why. So, and I got a big smile on my face, and the listeners can't hear me because I'm going to come across as like a dick right now, and I don't mean to. But in 1986, I had a feature article in Inside Karate magazine that the title was "A Word to the Wise." And WISE was spelled WHY'S. And so back in the '80s, and I make this joke because I think Simon does brilliant shit and he's a great speaker and I'm a big fan. So I was just saying that in the '80s, like I had realized when I started my company that I need to know why we're doing something. Why am I going to tell you to give somebody your wallet if he has a gun? Why am I going to tell you? And it was just this moral obligation, an ethical obligation, a legal obligation to myself, my family, my students to know why I was practicing something. I didn't want it to be just muscle memory or because, it was just passed down and this was tradition, because fighting has changed, right? If I said, James, man, we got like some bad shit. It's the zombie apocalypse. We got to go right now. Grab that spear. I got this bow and arrow and let's fucking find some horses. You might go, Tony, whoa, I've got the a truck and an AR and Glocks and like flamethrower and right. We don't need to use ancient weapons. There's a time to go, okay, how are fights changing? How are bad guys changing? And then to reverse engineer what you need to protect yourself. And so to that end, because people still confuse this, and it's become quite provocative and controversial, and it shouldn't be, but I was compelled out of frustration to create what I call the categories, and there's four of them. Category one I classified as all technical traditional martial arts, where your goal is the expression of the art. Category two were combat sports, boxing, MMA, savate, the things where you're actually hitting people, where you hear this sound, right? There's like skin hitting skin or leather hitting a face or whatever. And that changed, of course, how you had to train. But I said category two, and they're not in any particular order. It's just category two was all combat sports. And then category three was the new wave of reality-based self-defense programs like Krav Maga and all the arts that where the focus is just street defense. And what I need the listener and you to kind of meditate on here is that the moment you're part of a category where you're saying, this is how Krav Maga handles this. This is how jiu-jitsu handles this. This is how my instructor said we should handle this. You're creating an unconscious bias. Let me step out and offer this thought. There are individuals in every category that are freaking amazing. So this isn't people like when they hear me talk about this, they go, oh, he's knocking this shit. And that's just your myopic little, scared mindset. If you react defensively to this, I like to tell people the wonderful thing about bluntness is it gauges the strong and intimidates the weak. And if explaining categories makes you feel like I'm putting down your art, then you need to introspect. So that's a little detour there. We come back to that. If I ask a Taekwondo guy, what's he going to do at an ATM machine? If he turns around, there's a guy with a gun. He's naturally, the unconscious bias naturally selects something out of his Taekwondo toolbox. Agree?
Yeah.
And that's where you're going to go.
Flying axe kick.
Right. Whatever it is. I mean, it could be a front kick. It could be a back kick. It could be a reverse punch. I don't care what it is. And there's lots of traditional arts you know, that have like, you know, Hapkido and stuff like that, that have like gun disarms, and I'm sure Taekwondo does too. And, but it's going to be based on a very organized, if then go to complex motor skill. You practice it a certain way. Why? Because the practice, the Pavlovian conditioning, forces you to try to express, do your best to express the style. That's the only way you progress in the art and get your next level. The same thing, you know, if I ask an MMA guy does this, he does this. Oh, well, I'm going to Superman punch him. I'll double leg him. I'll ground and pound him. I'll fucking take him down. I'll do this. And if I ask a RVSD, reality-based self-defense guy, he'll say, I do this, I do this, I do this. But still, with all of the CCTV we have all over the world, with all of the smartphones taking pictures, when you watch real violence where a real violent predator attacks somebody in a true sense. I'm not talking about a douchebag fight, because there are a lot of people who post stuff online going, oh, look how jiu-jitsu saved the day. Look how Krav Maga saved the day. And they're selecting douchebag fights. And when I call a douchebag fight is a fight that you morally and ethically could have diffused or avoided. That if you stayed there posturing, you know, if you rolled up your sleeves, if you danced around, if you were drunk, if you were high, if you were like agreed to the fight, it's a douchebag fight. It's not a legal, moral, ethical, credible threat where you and your family were in danger. And so when I look at those things, we do not see, and I've got tons of stories where world-class fighters get injured, get killed, get their ass kicked by fucking asocial predators who just have no qualms about suddenly trying to hurt another human. Like they just don't have, they don't have a use of force, you know, paradigm. They just go, fuck it, here we go, boom, and they're done. And so the purpose of the categories was to try and have an intelligent conversation where I said, listen, those are the three categories. Where do you fall in those three categories? Because you may get really good at the wrong thing. And you need to differentiate between, like, if you use the word fighting, and I have for 37 years now that I've been teaching. And in the last year and a half, I've started to change the word fighting to violent encounter. And it's very iconic, and it's a very important distinction, because if I say to somebody, describe a fight to me, they might say Mayweather, Conor, McGregor. They might say, oh, I saw a guy, you know, punch a guy out outside of a bar. Like fighting conjures up, you know, punches to the face and punches to the body. And depending on what your background is, you get the picture of the fight. Where if I say describe a violent encounter, suddenly your brain goes somewhere else. And so we created category four to create a sniper-like focus on just what happens during a violent encounter. And things that we know factually are that violent encounters, the ones where we're at risk, you know, one of our maxims, that all fights are dangerous, but the most dangerous fight is an ambush, that one of the elements that make up the what a violent encounter would entail is it's a asocial predator who starts the fight. He doesn't announce it by texting you. He doesn't wave a flag and go, are you ready? There's no trumpet sound, right? It just starts. And so the first place you're attacked is emotionally, psychologically. And now we know from neuroscience, something that I've been talking about for decades, is that your cognitive brain, where you go, if he does this, I'll do that, and all your muscle memory skills gets bypassed by your reptilian brain. And what you'll see is a startle flinch. You'll see some sort of physiological response, and your body mind has to catch up to the violence, threat discriminate, and then start to figure out shit. But you're in this primal gross motor mode. So if your movement is technical, you've got some lag time where you've got to catch up. So what we did is, because my system has always been and only been since 1980 been about pure self-defense for, and I didn't have the language back then, for that violent encounter. What I did was I began reverse engineering. Everything was a scenario. Everything was like my 1986 article, A Word to the Wise. Here's why we're standing like this. Here's why we're going to practice this. And every movement we did was in response to the movement of the predator. And we always let the predator move first because we were replicating real violence. And so, you know, when I share this stuff, like I'm doing it really to make people safer. There's a video that I did. You're familiar with Caliber Press, right?
Actually, I'm not. No.
Okay, so Caliber Press is one of the biggest law enforcement training companies, educational companies. They have books and seminars. So I did I'm a guest author for a columnist for them from time to time, and there was a video of an Israeli soldier who got stabbed in the throat, almost like an Alfred Hitchcock like stabbing. I mean, so telegraphic and ridiculous. But it was three soldiers had walked up to some young guy in a marketplace in Israel and asked the guy for his papers. And this guy stood up and grabbed the guy by the head and stabbed him in the throat before he could do anything. And I posted online and I asked the question, because one would think, and here's an opportunity for a bunch of haters, one would think that the most authentic, realistic Krav Maga would be taught to the Israeli army, correct?
Yeah, I assume so.
Yeah. So I posted the question. I go, how come this Israeli soldier didn't use a Krav Maga knife disarm, right? I mean, the guy got stabbed in the throat and stabbed again before everybody kind of startled, flinched. And here's like three soldiers in full kit. And then one of them pulled out his pistol, and then a bunch of others came in, and the guy died by lead poisoning, not by some martial art, but not before he was able to stab and attack two or three soldiers. And all they did was what I talk about, startle, flinch, convert, move away from danger, organic airbag deployed, where they're, while their brain's going, what the fuck? And they're trying to catch up and scramble for space. My point here, before, you know, I've got a bunch of Krav Maga people like, you know, writing hate emails to me and stuff, is that had this happened in Thailand, I'd have said, how come this Thai soldier didn't use his Thai boxing? Because this was the empty hand range, right? They didn't have guns drawn. They were holstered. They were talking to a guy inside the reactionary gap. And if it had happened in Brazil, I'd have said, how come he didn't use his jiu-jitsu? And if it happened in France, I'd say, how come? In other words, what I'm talking about is what I said earlier, is careful what you practice. You might get really good at the wrong thing. That if you don't study the psychodynamics, the physiology, and the physics of the initial contact in an explosive violent encounter, then you might be compromising your safety. And if at the end of the day, part of your training is for personal defense so you can get home and see your family, you may be missing something. That's the whole point of creating the categories. I'm not saying don't continue to practice wushu. I'm just saying that maybe, jumping up and spinning in the air when this guy's lunging at you with a knife, like, isn't that practical. Maybe there's something that you need to be working on situationally and movement-wise before that. Anyways, I don't think I breathed for the last 10
No, but it's very pertinent, because I want to address that. It's an area that I've delved into with weapons training now. I know Tim Kennedy and the Sheepdog Response guys, they preach that a lot, not only with firearms, but also with unarmed combat. I've seen a clip of Tim on top of one of the guys at one of his seminars, and he's trying the traditional jiu-jitsu, and Tim's basically screaming at him, saying, I just pounded your face into the concrete, because he's, I'm assuming, doing the dojo-style jiu-jitsu. But this is a message right. That we need to get to all first responders, but obviously especially law enforcement, is you have all the best intention in the world when you take up a martial art. And, you know, and I've done martial arts for years, and I love them. But I have also personally seen how when I've been, you know, had suddenly someone in my face, I get that fear, startle reflex. But then when someone's bullying someone else, it's been a completely different platform that I'm on. I'm able to compose myself. And I really like what you talk about, that initial moment when you're out of control is not when you try and do your organized, you know, techniques, but when you gain control and you get your mind back into that control, that's when then you can use the rest of your arsenal to finish whatever needs to be done.
Right. It's funny you mentioned that, because I'd forgotten about this till you said it. But, you know, one of the slides in our law enforcement presentation was a distinction, or in our trainer's course, was a distinction between out of control tactics and control tactics. Everyone practices control tactics. Very few people think about, you know, out of control tactics. And that was my big thing in 1993 when I for lack of a better term, was discovered by Gary Klugowitz, who was the chairman of ASLET, the American Society of Law Enforcement Trainers. I was developing my high gear suit, and ended up having a 5-hour meeting with him because he was the lead for Redman on their scenario training. And so I was trying to get the company that manufactured Redman to manufacture my gear because I didn't know what it was going to go with it. I just had it as a concept. But I was explaining to him how, you know, just like you alluded to, you know, with Tim Kennedy, who I've known for years. He's a great guy, funny guy, smart guy, and really switched on. But, you know, it's the same thing. I'd go like you can't. And it's I summed it up a couple times already. That's confusing technical with tactical. Tim's on top, you know, smashing the guy in the ground, and this guy's trying to shrimp and find, you know, get his hips in the right place. And he's, you know, he's just lost 3 seconds of the fight, which might cost him his life. You know, in a structured fight where there are rules and there is a mat and there you go, mouth guard on and a cup on. And if you do get hurt, there's a medic there and a referee there. You can try whatever you want because that's your art form and that's how you're expressing yourself. But in the street, you should have a singular focus of, I need to get home as safely as possible. What do I need to do? And it's got to be moral, ethical, and legal, because then you got to live with what you did or didn't do. I completely forgot your question. I just, you know, you're zipping along here.
Well, no problem. We'll focus it back in. So category four, can you, especially with the law enforcement and military guys. So what do you bring to the table that changes some of their more traditional training with the Benny the Jet and some of the other things that they had before that?
Well, it's really a complete paradigm shift to start with. One is that whole, you know, like start with why versus, so ours is what's the scenario, right? When you practice, get to 2 o'clock, secure the wrists, you know, get ready for this arm drag, takedown, go, you know, get ready to do this cuffing. You're like 3 steps ahead. And you don't even know if this guy is going to sucker punch you, spin on you. You're just making this assumption. I wrote an article in 1993, called Presumed Compliance, The Theory of Presumed Compliance. It was subsequently published in Caliber Press's Street Survival workshop and manual for many, many years. I don't know if it's still there. But it's this notion that you just presume compliance. And when you do that, you change your reaction time, and we need to improve officers' perception speed to decrease their reaction time. The only way you can improve somebody's perception speed is to always layer training with credible scenario pre-contact cues and nuances. So you wouldn't just start at 2 o'clock. As an example, you would say, okay, like here's the suspect. And you're going to stand here. I need you to move here, but he's going to move too. Or, for example, how many cops practice weapon retention, where they start with their role player, wearing some sort of padding, and he's already on the handgun, right? You've seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what you're practicing is letting somebody grab your gun. Because all of the reps, the 10,000, let's go back to Bruce Lee's quote, the 10,000 reps, or the principle that Malcolm Gladwell made famous, that if you did 10,000 reps for weapon retention, you did 10,001 reps of letting a role player grab your gun. Part of your brain sees that initial lunge as a gun as part of training. And that's where part of the physiological, biomechanical, psychological confusion occurs, and it explains in a heartbeat. And I hope a lot of cops listen to this, because this is like truly a paradigm shifting principle, is that nobody who trains with me or any of my team practices weapon retention where a role player is allowed to grab the gun. The role player has to find a way to get to the gun, because let's step out and give you a more cartoony visual. If I could teach you like how to escape a noose, right? The hangman's noose. Like some people would go, that'd be cool. Like, show me that. And I go, it's a secret way that what you do is, you know, you contract your muscles like this. You got to train for this. And so, you know, your neck won't break. And by breathing this way, you're allowed to breathe, and you can pretend the guy's dead. And then when he does this, you do this kind of like kipping movement where you come up and then you've got this hidden knife in your sock and you cut yourself out. And like, that to me is like what complex motor skill martial arty stuff is like. When he does this, I'll do that, except that violates physics, because if the bad guy's moving first, you're always going to move second. You need something that is fast enough to intercept initial movement on the part of the bad guy in the ambush. And you going back to this hangman's metaphor, if I showed you that movement and I showed it and I said, I demonstrated it, go, look at this. See, my neck didn't break here. See, I can still breathe. And look at this. Oh, you can't bring your knees up to go upside down and cut that off. Oh, here's an ab workout, right? And this is the type of stuff that people practice. And I go, or we can just practice dropping the bad guy while he's tying the knot. Like, fuck getting in the noose, right? Now, someone could say to me, well, wait a minute, what if we get in the noose? I go, well, let's practice all the pre-contact cues to, that's a hangman. He's got rope in his hands. Oh, look, he's trying to throw the rope over the beam in my house. Maybe I should escape now. Maybe I should be looking for an improvised weapon. Maybe I should be tackling this guy or spearing this guy or kicking this guy or shooting this guy, right? But the way Pavlovian conditioning works is our brain downloads and executes movement programs when we get the right stimuli, when we get the right trigger. And this is so subtle. And again, it's the stuff we've been doing for 30 years. But now, you know, in the last few years, neuroscience explains a lot more about how the brain learns. And it's as simple as summarizes, if you improve your perception speed, you decrease your reaction time, you make people safer. So every single thing, you know, we ask, how does category four perspective change things, is you start with, if I ask the average cop who controls the fight, the average cop will say, what do you think? What do you think, James? Who
controls the cop does.
Right. Well, that's completely wrong, right? So listen to this. Who controls the location of the fight?
The bad guy.
Bad guy, right? You go to him. There's a bad guy here doing this. Who controls the level of violence when you finally have eyes on the bad guy?
He does as well.
Right. And who controls the length of the fight? When you say, drop your weapon, drop your machete, step away from the car, who controls the actual length of the fight?
The bad guy, again, depending on his reaction.
Right. But it's always the bad guy. If you step in there and you go, drop it, and he does, and you say, get on the ground, and he does, and you say, put your hands behind your back, and he does, the length of the fight was 15 seconds, and it was controlled by the bad guy. Because the moment you go to cuff him, if he goes into a push-up position to stand up and you step back and you go, get down, and you're like, what, you're right? And now the fight's 25 seconds because you had to, you know, give him more verbal warnings. The bad guy always controls the length of the fight. If you shoot him five times and then you gun jams and you pistol whip him, the length of that fight was controlled by how insane this bad guy was charging at you in a police-assisted suicide or whatever it is. And so the biggest paradigm we do is we tell people, just like we did right here on the show, I go, who controls the fight? You're the bad guy. I go, we do. I go, no, you need to win the fight. But what is the fastest way to create a spontaneous strategy? And that is to look at your opponent and figure out, based on his movement, what he's doing, his behavior, how to beat him. So if you love Thai boxing and your favorite move is a shin kick, and I happen to be a fucking pirate with a wooden leg, and you've never practiced breaking baseball bats, you might hurt your shin on me because you didn't look at me. You just threw the shin kick. And that's what I'm talking about, is why are we doing this? What is the safest thing we can do? And people confuse when I say choose safety with playing it safe. And they're very, very different. Choosing safety might be the safest thing I could do is shoot this guy in the face. The safest thing I could do right here is maybe barricade. The safest thing, like it's, you gotta be able to assess, threat discriminate, and then, because that's going to also serve you in what I call fight three, right? There's three fights. Fight one is between you and you. Do I have the will, the courage, the tenacity to move towards the danger? Fight two, do I have the skill and mindset to actually fight the bad guy? And then fight three is going to be, you know, mainstream media, internal affairs, conscience, you know, how are you going to handle like the third fight, the aftermath? And if you've got something that has congruent philosophy, that if you can say, okay, this is the right mindset, the safest thing I can do during situational awareness is this, the safest thing I can do during verbal de-escalation is this, what is the safest thing I can do, you know, during the physical confrontation? And, you know, then you're ahead of the curve. So what we do is like when I come in, I'm doing program management. We do stuff like for at the highest level, you know, there's elements in the Pentagon we consult with. There's different law enforcement, military all over the world. And we come in and we're not changing whether they like jiu-jitsu, Krav Maga, Gracie Grapple, or Taekwondo, or boxing, because every department, every organization has their DT combatives guy that has an unconscious bias. And the unconscious bias isn't bad. It's just this guy loves boxing. So when he does their combat PT stuff, it lends itself to more of the boxing flow. What I come in and I say, listen, this is neuroscience. This is brain-based learning. This is how people learn. So you, not everyone on your team is a stud. This isn't like not everyone in the department is tier one. Right. And so you've got, you know, whether it's court services or gang unit or undercover or SWAT or the street or whatever, everybody has a right to defend themselves. And so the training should be consistent with neuroscience, physiology, physics, and psychology. That's what we do as we come in. So it's not that the arm bar doesn't work. It's just that the arm bar is just one small part of that scenario.
Yeah. And I've seen that on some of the videos online where it has been someone startled, but they have used, I guess you could say, a technical response. And it seems to be the high level boxers where they've trained it to a point where it is reflexive and it's nearly always a straight right. But those are the ones where you see seems to be a lot in Russia. I don't know why, but the guy's jumped, you know, normally by multiple opponents and he basically knocks all of them out. But it's, again, a very simple straight right.
Is that the video you're referring to? Is that that old man outside the bar? Is that that street scene in Turkey? Or is that like you're talking about law enforcement?
Well, no, several of them. So you got the old man outside the bar. You've got it looks like a Russian or Eastern European guy. And three guys are attacking him and his girlfriend.
The reason I bring it up is I want to distinguish between, like, that's a douchebag fight, even though, you know, what I say is like the old guy outside the bar. I've been around the game long enough to go, like, this guy was at some, not only was he a badass, he was like talking to the guy. He knew he was going to drop him, and he was just waiting to see if this guy was going to stay in his face. It's very important that we distinguish if we're talking about like a law enforcement scenario where a cop is juggling use of force. He's worried about people videotaping him. We're in a fucking horrible era where everything is under a microscope. He's juggling all that, and then he's trying to figure out if this guy is asocial or antisocial, and if he's going to comply verbally, or if he's going to make a run, he's doing that. And the bad guy's only focusing on one thing. I'm going to grab his gun. I'm going to bite his nose. I'm going to punch him in the throat. I'm going to go. But those fights, listen, I can show you videos where, like, jiu-jitsu, the guy arm bars the guy or chokes the guy out. But what you have is like a really shitty, drunk asshole fighting a seasoned, experienced jiu-jitsu player. I want to make something clear, because again, remember my quote, the wonderful thing about bluntness is it gauges the strong and intimidates the weak. You know, I'm not knocking jiu-jitsu or boxing. I love both of those arts. I practice jiu-jitsu when my travel schedule allows. I got an amazing school near a Studio 540, and badass, go online and see the type of instructors they have there. I boxed for years. I used to box all the time, Taekwondo, Wing Chun, all this stuff there. But when I really started studying violence and violent encounters, I realized that I had to adapt and respond to how the bad guy's moving first. And I had to weather the ambush. Not just the physical ambush, but the emotional, psychological ambush. And that's the exchange. Now, to go to your point, if you're stress inoculating properly, right? So I have no doubt if the bad guys create time and space that allows a Thai boxer, a wrestler, an MMA guy, a jiu-jitsu guy, opportunity to do something, they're going to do it, because those arts, unlike many other arts in category one, those arts, which are like category two, they're force on force. So the thing about the category two stuff is that you're actually squeezing people. You're actually tapping somebody out. You're actually, you know, at risk of getting choked. And so that does wonderful things for stress inoculation emotionally, psychologically. Where those systems are lacking in terms of survivability is the situational awareness, the verbal, in some cases, multiple assailant or weapon disarm, because the focus is the bias of the arc. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so there's two examples that I use, and you can just Google MMA fighters Brazil, and it should come up. MMA, just Google MMA Brazil street fight. And what it is, it's two high level MMA fighters, you know, 4% body fat. You know, there's clips of them like in octagons. I mean, they're professional fighters. They get into a fight in the South America equivalent of a 7-Eleven with a couple guys. The fight pours outside. They're going toe-to-toe with douchebags, right? But this is a douchebag fight. And but the bravado and the macho behavior leads to the fight. And one of their guys, a third guy, appears, and he's got a 2x4 in his hand, and he comes running at one of the guys who's going toe-to-toe with one of his buddies. The guy picks it up. What does he do? He doesn't Superman punch. He doesn't do a rising block. He doesn't sidekick it. He doesn't do a crescent kick. He fucking flinches and moves, almost gets hit in the head with the baseball bat, with the baseball bat, with the 2x4. The guy swings at him again. I think he fell on the first swing as he's trying to get away. His other buddy is going toe-to-toe with another guy about, I'm going by memory now, like 10 feet away. But his back's to the guy with the 2x4. This guy does that Happy Gilmore swing from You're Gonna Die Clown in the Happy Gilmore movie. And he hits this guy across the back of the head. It's one of the most gruesome knockouts I've ever seen. The guy's uncooled, out cold. As soon as he gets hit, he falls down on the concrete. There's no sound, but you actually grimace when he hits the ground because he hits, you could see how hard he landed. And then the guy that he was fighting, or another guy, comes over and just starts wailing on this guy while he's unconscious, like coma, actually puts him in a coma. And, you know, I look at that and I show that sometimes and I go, if I showed you the initial douchebags versus the two MMA guys, and I said, bet right now, here's a clip of this guy, here's a clip of this guy, you're going to bet on the MMA guys. You look at their body, you look at their physique, you look at their background, you look at everything. But the MMA guys, all they had was their MMA. They didn't understand situational awareness. They didn't understand verbal de-escalation or distraction to set up stuff. They allowed their ego to get to draw them into a fight. And the ego is seduced by the unconscious bias. And this is what I mean by, like, that's a category two fighter confusing category two with category four. Those fuckers that they fought could not last 30 seconds in an octagon or a boxing ring. But they had no qualms about trying to kill people in a category four fight. And that makes them very dangerous.
Yeah, and you've just hit on a very important point too. It's something that I saw, you know, as a young man in England too, is in the cage, it's one-on-one. In the street, as, you know, as much cowardice, you know, as there is out there, I've never see a one-on-one, never see everyone just kind of step back and go, all right, let them fight. It's always some cowardly piece of shit that runs up and punches them when they're not looking or pulls out a weapon. So with your philosophy on that and trying to, you know, not engage in an all-out brawl, makes perfect sense when you start adding multiple attackers to the equation.
Right. I mean, that just compounds it. But if it was one-on-one, I would say the same thing, that, and that's where I want you and your listeners to start from, that, like, the multiple assailant, the coward who does the sucker punch, the king hit from the side there, you know, that's always a problem. But the problem was, how did you get there in the first place? Why are you in this confrontation? And so, you know, we break things down in a more systematic way, where we're actually teaching people to look at phases of confrontation, almost like a blueprint for violence. We refer to it in the seminar, the blueprint for violence, because if you can read a blueprint, you understand where the exits are.
Right. Now, I want to transition slightly from first responders. We talked a little bit about law enforcement. So what does your spear system training look like for the unarmed first responder, so the paramedic, the firefighter?
Yeah, and we've trained a bunch of them over the years. And listen, you know, we've got an operator program. We've got a gunfighting program. You know, at the end of the day, the Spear platform is pretty fascinating because it really resonates with something Musashi wrote in his Book of Five Rings: make your everyday stance your fighting stance, make your fighting stance your everyday stance. And so we've created a single platform where, from a nonviolent posture, I can transition to what we call the Spear stance, which is like a combat stance. And from that position, I can have a empty hand shotgun. I can have a fire hose in there. I can, you know, you're just moving through a crowd or moving through somebody in front of you. If I'm a first responder and I'm pulling a guy out of a car and suddenly he tackles me, startle, flinch, convert, my organic airbag deploys and I stop him. That angle of the guy spins on me on a wall search, the same sort of thing. I deploy the startle, flinch, I convert. We've figured out a very, very intelligent way to weaponize the flinch response, which is hardwired in every single person. If we transition to EMS, to corrections, to firefighter, to any other first responder, and I classify all, like, anybody who runs towards the danger to make our society safer as first responder. But the any stimulus that gets introduced too quickly can and usually will trigger some sort of flinch. So we teach the exact same protocol to a firefighter, to emergency response personnel. So if you've got, you know, some guy on a gurney who you just regain consciousness and the last thing he remembers was, you know, fighting a bad guy somewhere, he's gonna go right at you, you know. And so they're still gonna be in that moment, even though you're trying to save this guy, there's gonna be a startle flinch on your part. The difference being, maybe you're not gonna elbow him across the face right away. And you might have to, right? it can get into that. And back in the very old days, when they would teach rescue swimmers some close quarter fighting, how to headbutt, how to elbow, because you go to save somebody and they're panicking, they're going to grab onto you because you're the life vest, right? And so now both of you drown. And so sometimes, you know, and there's a couple of schools that still do it. It was interesting, where I would say, like, you can't just understand how to do mouth to mouth and pull somebody out of the pool. You might need to also fight the person, because if they're trying to grab you, you might have to drop an elbow, headbutt them to save both your lives. And so it's a whole different way to look at stuff. And you see the metaphor I mean there for that EMS guy is like, this guy's freaking out. And I need to protect myself, and I need to try and get this tourniquet on him or whatever. How do I control him? How do I protect myself first, and then how do I control his body? So there are direct applications there, but everything we do starts with understanding. Like, the first day of our course is a deep dive into the relationship between physiology, physics, biomechanics, kinesiology, and it's our proof of principle day, where we just say, look, regardless of gender, age, or size, we can make you stronger right away by understanding how your body and mind work naturally together. And then we start reverse engineering that into scenario aspects.
Right. Yeah, because the threat we have as firefighters and medics specifically, are varied from someone just coming out of a low blood sugar that you're just treating, that while they're in that state can be very, very aggressive, all the way through to obviously the very deliberate acts of terrorism that we also have to respond on. We may even be first on scene before law enforcement until we realize that that's what's going on. So I think that kind of course is very, very important. I did a very short one in medic school. They put us through for a day, and it was a kind of white belt level, just a kind of glimpse into, here's some things that might save your life. But I'm planning on coming up and doing your course in Louisiana so I can bring it back to my department, because working in Orlando and we have the theme parks, I'd say that we have a giant bullseye on our backs. So if that will save lives down the line, I think it'd be worth every penny.
Well, that'd be very cool. The big thing about our course is, like, we augment what you're already doing. And so, sometimes, again, people turn off and get a little defiant right away. I'm not going to inspire people to do better research if I'm polite and kiss everyone's ass. So I come right out and I say, look, there's no evidence that works. You should look here. And so people think I'm just trying to sell my course. And you know, and I mean this so sincerely that if this wasn't my company, this is the company I'd work for if I wanted to teach like the category four answer. Because I'm not, we don't teach people, oh, you got to use the spear. Like that's the spear is a serendipitous evolution of the startle flinch, which is you know, part of an 80,000 year old you know, DNA survival response that cavemen used when they started fighting other cavemen, you know. And I just looked at that, like, people cover their head and push away danger, and then noticed accidentally during a bunch of drills in 1988 that when I push away danger, my extensor chain was stronger than the flexor chain, so the bad guy trying to get on top of me did not have as much strength or stamina or endurance as me trying to push away. And I slowly figured out ways to sharpen that movement, to tighten it up. And those became our drills: finger splayed, outside 90, spear stance, spear flow drill. And so we're teaching the cognitive brain to respect and integrate what our reptilian brain is going to do, meant to do. And that's what we mean by weaponizing the flinch. So everyone can learn it, from a kid to a woman to a man. Pound for pound, it's the strongest thing you can do. But what we need to build an infrastructure around it of understanding essential and fundamental behavioral psychology, understand how to identify and mitigate fear, how to manage it. That doesn't mean to eliminate fear. That doesn't exist in many scenarios. It's how do I still perform while I'm stressed and while I have fear. So this isn't like a no fear, like the old no fear t-shirts, where, you know, you think, oh, and you know, I, when I'm really good, I'll have no fear. And we reframed that over two decades ago. We said, like, there is no such thing as no fear, but there is a way to get to no fear. And no fear is spelled K-N-O-W. No fear, you know fear by stress inoculating. You get to no fear, K-N-O-W fear, by actually knowing why you're going to do something, why you're going to practice a certain way, and how that's going to enhance your survivability. You get to no fear by kind of changing your paradigm and going, okay, the bad guy controls the fight. I didn't realize that, but yes, he does control the location and the level of violence and the duration of the fight. And if I look at him in that light, he will help me create the strategy that will beat him. And now your focus is singular and more zen-like, right? You're in the moment. You're not thinking about your last fight. You're not thinking about a future fight. You're right there in the fight there. And so the approach for category four, and again, this is my life work of going on almost four decades, man. I've been teaching professionally 37 plus years, is I need to understand more about situational awareness and self-awareness. If I don't have good self-awareness, that will cloud and skew my situational awareness. Because if I'm arrogant or prejudiced or have an unconscious bias or whatever, that's going to change what I see as danger. That will change how and when I perceive and receive a fear spike and how I handle that. And that's going to influence my movement or my idea of functional movement. And those are the three categories, not categories, those are the three phases: detect, diffuse, defend; detect and avoid; defuse and de-escalate; and defend. And so the system is totally congruent. It's based on science. It's based on physiology. It's based on physics. It's based on psychology. And you know, whether you're a firefighter, whether you're EMS, whether you're a soccer mom, whether you're a doctor, whether you're just like, you know, some kid in school, whatever, understanding you know, that you're the first responder in your confrontation, and understanding you're responsible. You know, we like to play with words as icons a lot. We write the word responsibility on a whiteboard and then put a hyphen between the word response and ability, right? And let everyone just look at that. At the end of the day, you know, we've been domesticated. We think the cavalry is going to rush in, but the reality is, you know, if you're holding your phone just as you're attacked, you don't even have time to dial 911. You know, so you got to take care of shit yourself, and buy that time and create that opportunity to escape or mitigate the violence. And it's a crazy thing that we need to talk about it like it's a new thing. But the world has always been violence. The people who understood violence and understood how to fight lived longer. That's all.
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I had a couple of questions that I put out online to see if anyone had questions for you. One you've already answered that was from Aaron Musgrove was about training us specifically, firefighters and medics. Another one that was a good question was from Axe Wielder. It was his Instagram name. I don't think it's his born name. Can you explain a little bit about the cycle of behavior?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, so the best answer for cycle of behavior is if he Googles cycle of behavior, there's actually clips and parts of me doing lectures about it, because I'm not going to do the fastest lecture I've ever done of cycle of behavior was about 17 minutes straight, right? And that's like blazing through it. So I would encourage, what I'm going to explain is what it is, and then your listeners that are interested can Google it. There's a good article on it. If you just Google Tony Blair's cycle of behavior, you'll see the graphic, so you can look at it as a map. There's an article on it, and then there's a bunch of videos that'll come up on it. We also break it down on one of my audio tapes on cerebral self-defense and metacognition. We've got a couple of MP3s out there all on mindset. But the cycle of behavior is something that I created back in the late 80s, and it's a basically what I refer to as the neural circuitry of fear. It's a block pattern showing kind of a map, starting with, of course, a scenario, leading us all the way around to the different thought processes, hesitation points, all the way leading to when act and actor finally become one. And that could be that. All that means is, okay, I'm going to hit this guy. Okay, I'm going to make that phone call. Okay, I'm going to draw my gun. Okay, I'm going to run away. Okay, I'm going to assert myself. So the last block is you stop thinking and deliberating. You're now in movement. And so, you know, there's a series of steps. And the metaphor, after 9/11, FedEx hired me to design a program that was taught to every one of their pilots. So an interesting concept for that is, just as an aside, it's a funny anecdote, is FedEx was started by former Marines. And after 9/11, you know, they went, oh, you know, we're not going to let anyone steal our airplane and use it as a bomb. What should we do? So what they thought like warriors, and they went around and they interviewed a bunch of the world's leading combatives consultants. And they ended up, you know, hiring me to design a program. And in the course I taught, and I, you know, cycle behavior is always a big part of people like the most, if you said to me, I only have an hour to train with you. What, you know, you can teach me a spear, you can teach me a kick, you can teach me a choke, you can teach me, all I'm going to do is work on cycle behavior. All I'm going to do is teach you fear management. Because I believe that every single person is a human weapon system. And what stops them from making the choiceless choice to move towards the dangerous fear. And so we created the cycle of behavior. And the reason I told you the FedEx story is because pilots are super, super smart. We're going through it. And one of the guys looks at the image that I created and says, hey, this looks like an electrical flow chart. And that kind of inspired the neural circuitry of fear, the term circuitry. And the metaphor there, if you're looking at it, is that if you metaphorically blow a fuse, meaning that at any one of the blocks, so the blocks go, you start off with a scenario, you start off motivated, and you've got these positive expectations, and then suddenly a stimulus changes. The guy produces a weapon. You see a cauliflower ear and go, oh shit, he's a MMA guy. You're ready to take this guy, and someone else steps out of the car, out of the shadows. And now it's like, oh shit, there's two guys. Like a stimulus gets introduced that triggers a fear spike. And now you're in what we call the fear loop. And there's a bunch of these blocks, you know, beliefs, expectations, visualizations. And each block, when one of the pilots at FedEx says, this looks like an electrical circuit, I went, holy shit, that's such a wonderful metaphor. Because if you blow a metaphoric fuse in any one of these blocks, the current, the power, gets shut off. And now you have what I call emotional inertia, your body and mind's inability to move. And you've seen that. We've got videos of military, law enforcement, civilian, citizens, like hesitating when they need to run, hesitating when they need to draw a weapon, hesitating when they need to fight. And what that is they, I mean, people are like, shit, they were scared shitless there. Well, no, they were in the fear loop. It was emotional inertia. And what they had done is their nervous system, the communication, what we call like a neuromuscular communication, got shut down. And so this is kind of like, this doesn't appear on these videos. This is kind of like the background, the substance under the subject. But I'm trying to sprinkle magic dust and cram a bunch of information on this for the guy who asked the question. But there's a ton online that explains how to go through it. But it's really a map on how do I navigate duress when I've got like my inner voice saying things like, oh shit. Right. As you know, so that's
brilliant. Well, the reason he was asking was applying that to other areas of our job too, like on a fire scene and you know, other incidents that we respond to. So what I'm going to do, I've actually saw one of the first two YouTube videos that you have explaining that. So if you go to jamesgearing.com, I will put the links to Tony's page of this episode at the bottom. So you can just go ahead and click on that and actually see the videos that he's talking about. All right, so I got one more question from a listener, and then we'll do some short wrap-up questions. So Matt Reddy asked, how can I get Spear in Washington State?
Well, depending on who you are and what you do, we've got programs for, again, like the first responder community. We've got programs for the general public. We've got programs for professional martial artists, self-defense instructors who want to integrate my research. So not knowing his background, I would say, hey, get to my website, blauerspear.com, blauerspear.com, and kind of just snoop around there. How do I get in the state? Like, you know, if you're a cop, you'd find an agency to host. If you're a businessman, maybe your company sponsors something. If you're, you know, a concerned parent or dad in the community, you know, we've got a mobile training team. We do a lot of like, you know, little small seminars for like groups of 18, 24 people, where somebody just takes the initiative and goes, hey, we're going to bring you, we have a course called Be Your Own Bodyguard. And it's a 1 day intensive. You know, some people go, you know, think you can't learn how to defend yourself in a day, and you absolutely can. In the same way you can learn CPR in a day, in the same way you can learn basics of first aid, where you develop the skills to save somebody else's life, but not to save your life, right? And so understanding more about situational awareness, understanding more about verbal de-escalation will change your survivability and your relationship to violence immensely. And then what we, you know, so he may be talking about like hosting one of those things. Best thing to do is, you know, snoop on our website. There's a ton of stuff up there. If he wants to get the course there, we might also have an affiliate there. I don't remember where all my affiliates are. We've got, you know, trainers all over the world. So there's an affiliate link on my website as well.
Brilliant. Now, I'm a CrossFit coach as well, part-time when I'm not at the station. And one thing I haven't asked you yet is, how did you become involved with the CrossFit community?
Yeah, so it's a kind of a funny story. Back in 2005, I did a talk at a Tactical Expo, and somebody said to me goes, hey, you remind me of Greg Glassman. And I said, who's Greg Glassman? He says, oh, he's the founder of CrossFit. I go, what's CrossFit? And he goes, oh, it's a fitness thing. But I go, well, how could a like fitness guy remind you of me? He says, it's just some of the things you say. One of the things that I always tell people is that circumstantial spontaneity and the ability to improvise is going to determine, you know, the outcome of your confrontation, that you can't have a favorite move. Your favorite move might trigger his best counterattack, and now you're screwed. And you know, that resonates deeply with CrossFit's original charter and Greg's original language of, you know, to be prepared for the unknown and the unknowable, right? And movements that are elemental and fundamental to your survival, where, you know, he said it more eloquently, but I would just say, you can't have a favorite move. You can't specialize. So these trainers at these tactical conferences were hearing that thread through the philosophy. And then I was on the East Coast. It was a Trexpo conference. So I was speaking on the East Coast, West Coast. And then I go to the East Coast and somebody else says, you remind me of Greg Glassman. There's something in the language. So I go to the CrossFit website, and it's 2005. And I'm looking at this website and I'm going, hey, these guys are like giving away workouts for free. There's like hundreds of people commenting. I was like blown away. So I'm lurking. Then a third person at another training says something. And I'm like, what the hell? I'm down at Fort Bragg doing a seminar. I walk in to do some force on force training. I got our Higer suits. I got red and blue machine guns for training. We're going to do this whole like force on force scenario. And as I walk into the gym, there's a whiteboard there that says WOD. It says what the hell was the workout standby? It was 10 or 15, what was it, 15 push-ups, 10 squats, 5 pull-ups.
Yes.
Angie, right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't say Angie, and then it says 20 AMRAP. So it's very vague, five pull-ups, 10 push-ups, 15 squats, 20 AMRAP. And I'm like, as I'm walking by, I stop, I go, hey, what? I go, you guys having trouble doing like, 5 pull-ups, 10 push-ups, 15 squats? And the guy laughs, he goes, huh? And as he's about to explain it, I go, what's 20 AM? He goes, that's 20 minutes. And still, like, if you've never done a CrossFit workout, you have no idea how much that sucks, right? And so, I make fun of it a little bit. I go, what's WOD? He goes, workout of the day. And then I go, what the hell is this? He goes, it's CrossFit. We're experimenting with CrossFit. And I say to myself, CrossFit? We're at turn now, I hear CrossFit. So I'm lurking on their website, and I send Greg Glassman an email saying, hey, I've heard about you. We seem to know some similar people in the same field. I'd like to connect and learn more about your stuff. About a month later, he got back to me. I was teaching Las Vegas Metro PD and called me up like we'd known each other. He had been hearing about me from other people. And so he said the same thing, and he said, look, you can't talk about CrossFit. You got to do it. Why don't you come as my guest and come do a cert? And it was back when he was still teaching. My first course was May 2006. I flew out to Santa Cruz, and Coach Glassman and I, I've been, good friends with him ever since, and involved with the community since 2006. If there's about 30 plus videos of me on the CrossFit main site. They've changed it since, I don't know where you find it now. They're, I guess it's on their YouTube channel now, but, all sorts of stuff like, cycle behavior, finger split, outside 90, Saving Private Ryan drill, all these, all these things, and worth a good look there. But what a great community. Love the community. And I knew I fell in love with the community because there's so much politics in the martial arts and so much backstabbing and so much bullshit. All I ever wanted to do was make people safer. All I wanted to do is make people safer. And when I say, how come this Israeli soldier didn't use his Krav Maga, I'm trying to be provocative to get people to go, this guy lacked situational awareness. This guy didn't have a startle flinch protocol, didn't understand how to weaponize a flinch. This guy presumed compliance and he got stabbed right in the throat as a result. And he didn't deserve it, but there was something missing in his training. How else can you explain it? And when I say stuff like that, again, it's not to diss Krav Maga or jiu-jitsu or anything like that. I love all movement. I don't care if you're fucking showing me a clip of a ballerina or a hockey player or football player. I love watching athletes move who are in control of their body, but we need to understand the game. If you can play flag football, it doesn't mean you can play tackle football. Just assuming that because you can catch a ball and run, that you can just jump on a field with tackle football players, you're going to get your ass kicked, right? And just because you can play football doesn't mean you can play rugby, right? Even though stuff looks the same. And that's all I'm just saying to people is understand the categories. So went off on a mini tangent there just because of the CrossFit thing. What resonated with me is I was at the 2008 games at the ranch, and I noticed something very peculiar, that the person that finished last got the biggest roar and support from the crowd, that unlike all other sports, nobody left because everyone knew how agonizing and sufferable the workouts were. And I went, holy shit, like everybody was united by mental toughness and pain.
Right? Yeah, absolutely.
And so, where I didn't experience that in school, I didn't experience that in martial arts, I didn't experience that in other sports, where if you finished the race first, you went to celebrate and the losers were the losers.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I love about the CrossFit community, it fills two voids. Firstly, just like you were talking about, stress inoculation. If you can constantly put yourself in a horrible place, and you know, at the appropriate times, not every single workout, but you know, when you're physically hurting as a first responder, obviously that carries over to your job. And then also that sense of community in this smartphone tablet holding world that we're in now, you know, where you can be in the middle of a suburban community and feel like the loneliest person on the planet. You go to somewhere like a CrossFit gym, and not only is it amazing when you're doing the workouts, but also like my guest last week, Amanda Marsh, she was the widow of Eric Marsh, who was one of the 19 firefighters that was killed in Prescott, Arizona in 2013. The CrossFit community came together and did this huge event and raised money for them. So that to me speaks volumes about what CrossFit's about.
Right. Yeah. No, I remember that well. Amazing.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to ask just a couple of wrap-up questions so I can you know, let you get on with your day. First question I always ask people, is there a book that you recommend to people? It can be what we talked about or something completely different.
Wow. I haven't read a lot lately, but I used to be a voracious reader. You put me on the spot there. I think that there's in this day and age, recently read Ryan Holiday's book on Stoics. I would recommend that people check that out, and just because there's so much shit going on in the world, that it's just a good reframe, mindset reframe. A book that really kind of changed how I looked at fear and what I wanted to do with that was a book by Bryce Courtney. I read it like 20 years ago called The Power of One. And, it really depends on the theme. A good fun book, Essentialism, this notion that, you can have like 10 really amazing ideas, and really important things to do, but really you need to do one and get it done. And so I read a lot, but I don't know if you have to be like business, spiritual, self-help, I actually have a reading list of, I think, about 50 books online on somewhere on one of my blogs.
Okay. Now, The Power of One, that was that the story about the young boy in South Africa, or is it completely different?
No, that's it.
That's the one. Yeah. That's an amazing. They made that into a film as well. It was one of the best films I've seen to date.
Yeah, the book, the film was good. The book's amazing.
Okay. All right, I'm gonna have to get that then. All right, so we're talking about movies. So, is there a movie and or documentary that you recommend to people?
Oh my God, my brain is going. Is drawing a blank. There's of course Enter the Dragon. No, just kidding. I've got a lot of favorite movies, and I'm just drawing a blank now. Like after that intense talk, I suddenly lost all my memory. But I love action movies. I love like Rocky when I came out when I was 16, and it's funny because I was just talking about it. I guess it was the 41 year anniversary of Rocky last week or this week, and somebody posted that online, and I was like, "Are you kidding me? Like, how old am I?" And classic movies. Like Rocky. There was one Australian or New Zealand movie. I think it's called Once We're Warriors.
It is, yeah, an amazing movie about the Maori guys.
Yeah, yeah, and I recommend that to people who are cavalier about violence. And while it's a great story and a tough movie to watch, the violence in there, when you see it, like comes closer to what I'm trying to help people understand. So it's kind of like those, you just watch it and you go, whoever choreographed that has seen that, because that was so well done. So there's two for you.
Okay, and I'm going to steal one from your interview with, I forget the podcast name now, but it was a martial arts one. But you mentioned The Raid as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just in terms of choreography and athleticism and just special effects, the Raid has some amazingly graphic and theatrical fight scenes in it, and very creative. And I just really enjoyed it. You know, even like Ong Bak, the Tony Jaa movies, his first movie was just insane, the stuff that he was doing. But of course, like, don't watch that, guys, and go, oh, that's what happens in the street. That's not
right. You're not going to do a flying knee over a cart.
Right.
All right. What do you do to decompress when you're not teaching spear?
These days, I literally try to do a meditative walk every day. Really discovered some interesting research on the power of walking. I actually do, guided meditation, really focus on breathing. People should check out my buddy, Brian McKenzie's Art of Breath, seminars. And, so my protocol of decompressing is really, conscious breathing, like really focus on training my diaphragm and my relationship to, inhale and exhale, meditating and walking. That's just to regulate my state. And then I love movies and I love reading and sometimes, self-awareness is key, where you start to feel like things are going too fast and things are going too tense and being able to just step away, so that's kind of my routine these days.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm seeing that common denominator in so many people. They A, go out into nature, and B, do some sort of meditative practice, excuse me. I got one more question before we just talk about where we can find you and all your work. If you could recommend a guest to come on the Behind the Shield podcast, who would that be?
Oh, wow. Man, I wish Brian McKenzie. I would try to get Ryan Holiday. I don't know if he does podcasts. He's the really inspirational writer. Greg Glassman. These are people who Dr. Eric Goodman.
I had him on already. Eric and I did the foundation training class a couple years ago. So, yep, he's been on here. And actually, he reached out to me through Instagram and said, you're one of the nicest guys he'd ever met. So there you go.
Yeah, Eric's a great guy. So, I mean, I mentioned like Glassman, Eric, Brian, Ryan. These are people who it's funny. I got a 25-year-old son, 20-year-old daughter, 15-year-old daughter, company, staff, team, mobile training team, different divisions. And here I am, 57 years old. And the most important stuff to me right now is like regulating the stress level in my body so that I can function and perform the other stuff. And the stuff that I'm using is, foundation, breathing, and meditation. And I'm still doing so. It's that proverbial work-life balance, that the gurus talk about. But I mentioned those four people because, CrossFit has had a big impact on my life and my fitness for the last decade. And then recently discovering foundation, which has really helped with my back and my posture. And then Brian with the breathing, fantastic stuff. And what he's done with the breathing is taken out the mystical and made it all about the research and the science and its relationship to working out, state, anxiety, fear. And so it really resonates with our whole approach to, managing fear and the notion of there is no such thing as no fear, but there is a way to get to no fear, Kane or W fear. So I just share those things because I don't know that I would have been wise enough if at 25 you told me, if all four of those guys existed, if you told me at 25, you got to start studying CrossFit, you got to start conscious breathing, you got to start meditating and you got to do foundation training every day. At 25, I might have just ignored it and only realized the value of it, 27 years later, or much longer, But it's an interesting thing because I share this shit with my kids and they look at me like I'm, talking Latin, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, the foundation training, especially, I've taught everyone in my fire department already. I went over to California, got certified with Eric, came back and did seminars for all my guys, and yeah, there was buy-in with people that have been hurt before. And that was the problem. It's like, I just wish I could get you to realize if you do this every day, you probably will never get hurt. But sadly, it's going to be when you tweak your back, when you hurt your back, which is what happened to me, how I found him in the first place, that's when you're going to start doing it. But if that's the case, then so be it. But obviously with what we're talking about today, hopefully this will be preemptive because, this information will be too late if it's a fatal attack that you suffer.
Exactly.
So, all right. Well, I'll definitely get in contact with you to try and get some of those guys on the show because I would love to have everyone that you mentioned. But back to you. So for everyone listening, I'm going to put all of your links onto the webpage, which is jamesgearing.com. So where can people find you on social media and then the websites that you have out there?
Yeah. So, the company website is blauerspear.com and I have a Patreon page, which is kind of a neat page. It's patreon.com/Tony Blauer. And it's kind of go check it out. I'm going to explain what it is, but it's a way for people to kind of get little tastes of our philosophy and our movement, on there. And, we of course are on Instagram. I've got, several Instagram pages. If you want my provocative, philosophy on take on politics, douchebags, training, food, really bad humor, just follow me on at Tony Blauer. If you want stuff that's more of our training, our tactical, it's spear.system on Instagram. And then we've got our high gear equipment, spear.gear. And you'll find it all in there. And of course, Facebook, we've got Tony Blauer and the Spear and my page. You'll get it on there. If you're into that stuff, just go follow. There's a ton. Everyone needs to use Google. Just Google it.
Okay, Tony. So thank you so much for coming on. I mean, I was blown away when we connected on Instagram. I know you were on the Squad Room. I'll give them a shout out, which is a fellow law enforcement officer out in California who has a great podcast as well. Being well embedded in the CrossFit community for almost 10 years myself now, I feel truly blessed to have got you on here and try and sow some seeds again like we do every week with the first responders, but especially our brothers and sisters in law enforcement who this truly could make a huge difference in the way they look at their job.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you. Thanks for coming on your own podcast, James.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate. I love doing these, and the fact that you got a captive audience in law enforcement, firefighter, first responders, and so on and so forth. Undervalued, under-respected, under-thanked. I don't even know if those are all words, but I just made them up. And anything we can do to enhance their safety and survivability, we should do because they're not paid enough for the stuff that they have to do. And so it was my pleasure and almost duty to get on the show and do whatever I can and share whatever tips or ideas I could.
Well, thank you. And like I said, I'm going to make it work where I can come and take a class in the beginning of next year. And then maybe in the future we can reconnect and we can talk about it after I've actually been through your system.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic. Just hit me up.
Brilliant. Okay, well, you have a great day. Thank you so much.